These days, publishers can barely keep up with the demand for picture books. But only a few, like Goodnight Moon, Madeline, and Curious George, have turned into classics. So what makes a great picture book? Steve Paulson asked three experts. Kevin Henkes is the author and illustrator of the prize-winning books Owen and Lily's Purple Plastic Purse. Uri Shulevitz is also an author and illustrator. His award-winning books include Snow and The Fool of the World and the Flying Ship. And Barbara Barstow is a librarian who's chaired the Caldecott Medal Committee. They all say a classic picture book exudes a certain kind of magic. Take Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, the story of the boy Max, who made mischief of one kind and another. His mother called him Wild Thing, and Max said, "I'll eat you up." The words suck you into the story, but the illustrations are what really bring it to life. Kevin Henkes.
It's drama in which the pictures get larger as the story intensifies, and it comes to a climax, and when it draws to an end, the pictures become smaller again, and it finishes on a page in which there is text but no illustrations at all.
When I was looking at that book last night, I was noticing how incredibly compact it is. I mean, just within three pages, you find out everything. You find out that Max is being yelled at by his mother. Max is angry. The forest starts to grow in the room. It's as if there's no word that's wasted, word or picture.
And I think that's one of the things that makes a great picture book. And I also think that it's original. There's nothing new about a kid getting into trouble or throwing a tantrum and working through it and having a happy ending, but it's how he did it that makes it unique.
Uri Shulevitz, what's your take on that book? What makes that book so special?
Well, to begin with, I mean, it is a true picture book, as Kevin has mentioned. I would like also to mention something, I mean, as an aside, but about Where the Wild Things Are, as compared, for example, to Peter Rabbit. In both books, what they have in common is that the hero disobeys mother. In the tale of Peter Rabbit, he's punished for it. I mean, he barely escapes with his life, pursued by Mr. McGregor. At the end, he's sick, and as a kind of a slight compensation, he's having chamomile tea, which he may not really care for very much.
Although some people read that as punishment, that he doesn't get
well,
the other stuff that his sisters
right.
get.
But that is not the case with The Wild Things Are. The Wild Things Are is something, it's quite different. Although Max disobeys his mother, he not only is not frightened by these creatures that are much larger than Mr. McGregor, but he actually comes out victorious. And not only that, when he returns, he's rewarded by a delicious supper waiting for him.
Well, Barbara Barstow, one thing that's striking about Maurice Sendak's books in particular, and I think Where the Wild Things Are is a perfect example, is there's a dreamlike quality to that.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't just work on the conscious level.
Even the dreamlike quality, I think one of the most powerful things about this book is that it speaks directly to the child. There is no heavy-handedness to this book. There is more than meets the eye with this.
When you say child-centered, you're never getting the parent's perspective here.
I
mean, you're never getting a parent preaching and saying, you know,
exactly.
Max, you should be doing this. It's all from Max's point of view.
I think so. And the least successful children's books, picture books, winking over the heads of children, really speaking to adults. But Maurice Sendak is speaking to the child audience, and perhaps from his own memories of childhood and those dreams, the ability to conquer those things, which I think is what every child wants, the ability to be powerful enough to conquer the evil around them or the nightmares, the things under the bed.
Is that the secret of all great picture books, essentially getting inside the heads of the kids themselves, tapping into that childlike experience?
I think that's one very important thing. And I think if a book does become classic, it is because a child, many children, love it and want it again and again and again. A good example of keeping the child in mind is Vera Williams' book, More, 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 Said the Baby. It's just very simply a story about three children who have a loving experience with an adult. And the word love isn't in the book at all. And there are so many books out there now that I think are from an adult perspective that have love in the title and love is on every page. And this doesn't have that at all. The children have the adults kissing their toes and kissing their belly buttons, things like that, that are very child-centered. And I think that's why it's such a wonderful book. And it oozes love.
Well, I think that this is true, but also on the other hand, it's not that important, in other words, whether it's child-centered and whether it's speaking directly to the child, you know, by trying to do it that way. I believe that the good picture books, I mean, were first and foremost good books. The first books that children adopted were not written for children. Stories from the Bible, Don Quixote, Robinson Crusoe, none of them were written for children.
Don't all good picture books have to work both for the child and for the parent? I mean, after all, it's the parent who has to read it over and over and over.
I think that's probably true, and I think most good books have layers. A good book can be enjoyed on a certain level by a child, and that same book can be enjoyed enormously by the adult.
I also think that less than great books can be very much appreciated if an adult that loves that book and loves that child shares it with the child, because sometimes it's the bond between the two that makes you love the book.
Well, let me tell you my reaction to a different kind of reaction when I first read The Little Engine That Could to my daughter, and I probably hadn't read it since I was a kid myself. I'm sort of embarrassed to say this, but kind of tears welled up in my eyes when I got to the end, you know, that I think I can. And I remember that happened the first few times. Now I can't stand the book. Now it just seems so preachy, repetitive.
Yes.
The few times that I read it now, I skip whole sentences because I just find it boring. And
does she let you get away with it?
She does with that one.
Uh-huh.
There are other books that that she doesn't.
So maybe it didn't pass the test for
maybe,
her either.
Yeah, maybe that's true.
I view it very simply this way. It's either a good book or not. I really don't believe in those distinctions, whether the book is for children. If the book is simple enough and speaking to the human being, it comes down to whether it's a good book or not.
Let me ask about illustrations, the role of illustrations, because one thing that I notice with a lot of picture books that are coming out now, ones that are not classics, is the art is sometimes beautiful. It's, you know, these elaborate, ornate paintings. And you go back to some of those old classics like The Runaway Bunny or Curious George. I mean, very simple drawings. And I actually wonder if the art can be too beautiful to work well.
I think frequently that does happen. What happens is that the very, very ornate things, the things, sometimes they overwhelm a story. Sometimes they take away from the child's participation.
And I think that's the difference with certain over-illustrated books or whatever you want to call them. I think they're beautiful paintings often, and they would look terrific in one's house. But an illustration has a different function.
Right.
And I think a good illustration, you can't take it out of the book. It's part of the whole.
You're quite right that there are a lot of very beautifully illustrated books now, more so than they were at the time when I started in the 60s. But one thing, you know, and this is kind of a generality, so it doesn't hold always true, but most of the time, they had a great deal of feeling. And today, unfortunately, there are some very beautiful books, but they don't have as much feeling.
Well, let me ask you about Curious George. And I don't know if you are Curious George fans around this table. You can tell that I'm being guided by the preferences of my children here. But a Curious George just ruled in my household for a long time. And I'm sure it has a lot to do with the pictures there. And I would guess from an artist's perspective, this is not great art, but I don't know. Somehow it's very captivating.
I think they're utterly charming. And I think H.A. Rey, again, I mean, they work. Those characters are alive on the page. They move. George, in his nonsensical way, is real in the way that I think other drawings can look stiff.
Even though the pictures are, they look very simple.
Simple is
probably
hard to achieve.
Yes. Exactly, yes.
M.B. Gofstein had a quote that was something like, you work and work and work until it looks like you didn't work at all. And I think that's, again, often the case with a good picture book.
Let's talk about the texts of some very well-known books. Goodnight Moon, the text is so spare, so poetic. What makes that work? What makes that endure, that book, so that I, as a parent, for instance, can read it over and over and I don't get tired of it?
I think you mentioned two things. It's spare and it's yes. poetic. And I think there's not a word there that doesn't need to be. It moves, and you want to know what comes next. You want to turn the pages.
But it is larger than itself, and it does go beyond the child's world. I mean, at the end, the child says goodnight, I think, to the universe. So in other words, it really progresses. I mean, really from the everyday objects, you know, it keeps on going. Then, you know, good night stars, good night moon. So therefore, the book is not slight. Slight would be if all you get is all you see and that's it.
So really what you're saying is some of these books that become classics, they work at a metaphorical level. Mm-hmm. It's not simply dealing with the world at hand, but I guess it's, Kevin, what you were saying, and they work on different levels right. and they somehow tap almost an unconscious level.
I think probably any good art does that, whether it's a picture book or a painting or sculpture.
I would use an analogy about this thing. It's like you're flying over an ocean and you see a tiny island. And what you see is actually, that's really what you get in the picture book. But a great picture book has also the fact that this tiny island is only the tip of a huge mountain and that the bigger part is invisible. It's implied.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
For example, The Happy Day by Ruth Krauss. The words are extremely simple. Mm-hmm. Different animals wake up, they run, they stop, they dance, and at the end, a flower is growing in the snow, and that's all. So what you see is actually, what's the big deal about it? It's just one little flower in the snow, but actually what it is, it's a cosmic event. It's the first day of spring. Hmm. And I think that it's just telling you about it, kind of. I feel like I'm my hair is standing up. And I think this is really what I mean by something that is larger than itself.
Uri Shulevitz and Kevin Henkes are both writers and illustrators of picture books. Barbara Barstow is a librarian who's chaired the Caldecott Medal Committee. They talked with Steve Paulson.